Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Discover luxurious duvet sets today. Visit harrycurry.com for stylish comfort this spring. Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Revamp your home this May with our fresh new curtain and bedding designs. Discover comfort and style for every room.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You are very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannan with you until 3 o'clock on this Friday. And here we are today, just really taking in the detail of this really quite shocking report that has been released in the last hour. This is the report that's telling us that hundreds of children who underwent operations, serious operations for hip dysplasia in Temple Street Hospital and Kappa Orthopaedic Hospital, hundreds of children should never have had those operations. That is what we are reading in this report, that in almost 70% of cases, children who were referred to those hospitals and had surgery for that condition would not have met the threshold elsewhere. Those operations shouldn't have been done on those children. Kerry, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Katie. How are you?
I'm great, Kerry. Tell me about your daughter. She is 5 now, is that right?
She is, yeah. She's just turned 5, yeah.
And this hip dysplasia that we're learning all about now, that runs in your family, does it?
Yeah, it does. There's a couple of members of my family who have hip dysplasia. One of my cousins only got diagnosed with it at 12, so she ended up having to get a full hip replacement at the age of 17, so it's quite strong in my family, yeah.
Okay, so you were kind of, this was in your mind in terms of your own daughter,
yeah,
then. So at what point was there concerns raised?
So I think she was a day old. The paediatrician came in to do the exam. She said she didn't feel any kind of clicking or looseness, but she listened to me. She was lovely. She said, look, because of the family history, we'll definitely send her for a scan. And then when she was about 10 weeks old, we went back to the hospital for the scan, and that's when they detected it.
Okay, and what did they suggest as a treatment plan at that stage?
So because her hip was actually dislocating, it was coming out of the socket, they said that they needed to do an urgent referral to Temple Street. So within a week, we were in Temple Street getting a Pavlik harness fitted.
And that is, it's a tough one, isn't it, having a baby in a harness like that?
Really hard, yeah. Really, really hard.
Just explain to people, the harness, is it's keeping the legs totally displayed, basically, isn't it?
Yeah, so the Pavlik harness keeps the hip in place, basically. You know, babies, they kick and everything like that. So the nurse will hold the hip in place and put the harness on just so that the actual ball can't come out of the socket.
Right, yeah. So you can imagine with a little baby how tricky that is, just having to do anything with her at all.
Yeah.
So she had that for 6 weeks, then another x-ray?
Yeah, then another x-ray. We were told we were moving on to the abduction brace. So she was in that full time, I think, for around 4 months. And then we had another x-ray and we were told she could wear it just at night time and nap time for another 3 or 4 months.
Right, so you were doing everything you could. And I know that I've talked to other parents with that who had a child in that harness. It just means it's almost impossible to manoeuvre a child in that, even like car seat-wise and that.
You have to think of everything. Clothes, you have to get a bigger size. You can't bath them. You know, you have to prepare for everything in advance.
Okay, but you thought, okay, this is it. This will save us, I suppose, from any...
Well, look, we're doing it, but we're not doing it in vain. We're doing it for a reason, you know?
Yeah, that you can avoid the actual surgical issue down the line. So then, when did it progress again then that there was... it looked like she would actually need the surgery?
So we went for an x-ray once she was done with the brace. And about 2 weeks later, I got a call from Temple Street to say that she was being put on a surgery wait list. We'd probably get a letter in a year and then we'd kind of just go from there, which I was shocked because surgery had never been mentioned, not once in any of the consultations. So I was talking to my GP and she said, look, why don't you get a second opinion? No harm. I said, okay, yeah, fair enough. So we did. We got a second opinion with a consultant in Temple Street as well. And he did his own x-ray and said, well, whether she needs surgery or not, there's absolutely no point in doing it until the hip is stabilized. So she needs a spica cast for 16 weeks before we can even consider that. So then she'd wear a spica cast for 16 weeks.
Okay, and when what's a spica cast then, Kerry? What does that look like?
It's a plaster cast, basically, from her ankles up to her chest. It's horrible. Honestly, it's horrible. You can't wash them properly. You have to get special adapted car seats, high chairs, buggies, clothes. It was really hard.
But again, you were thinking this will save us from any surgical procedure.
Exactly, yeah.
So you're putting up with it, and she's putting up with it. And
yeah.
Okay. So at what point now? What age is she at this stage, Kerry?
Just before she turned one.
Okay. So what was your next encounter with the medics?
Once the spica cast came off, we went back for another follow-up x-ray, and it was COVID time, so my husband was outside. He was on loudspeaker on the phone. It was just myself, my daughter, and the consultant, and he got the x-ray up on the screen, and he said, okay, so good news, the spica cast did its job, the hip is stabilised, but she still needs surgery. So my heart sank, and I said, look, I've been doing my own kind of research, and I know there's times where as the child grows, the hip can grow with the child and almost kind of fix itself. Could that be an option? Could we hold off? And I still remember the words he said to me. He said, Kerry, I've been in this game a long time. And yes, sometimes that can happen, but it's quite rare. He goes, I know by looking at this x-ray, that will not happen. The only way that these hips will be fixed is surgery. So I said, okay, put it on the surgery list.
What else could you say, really, with that referral?
So
very reluctantly, you went along with this.
Yeah.
And then an unexpected thing happened for you.
Yes, it did. So this would have been maybe 6 months later. It was definitely a couple of months. And we got a call. So the consultant said that the surgery would be done in Kappa Hospital. So that we'd be referred to there. And we got a call from them, as I said, probably about 6 months later, to say it was in and around the time of the scoliosis cases. And I think the consultant was kind of dealing with that. So they rang me and they said, look, you can stick with that consultant if you want, but it's going to be at least 6 months before we can even give you a date for review. Or we have someone else who's taking over some of his cases. You know, you could probably have an appointment in the next month. So I didn't know what to do. This was already our second opinion. I thought, do I want to go to a third doctor? You know, I was kind of happy with the original one. As I said, I trusted that that's what she needed and we were doing the right thing. But I thought, wait, in 6 months, it's too much. So we decided we'd go. And they said, look, you can go and meet this other consultant. And if you want to stick with the original one, that's fine. There's no pressure. So we said, okay. So we went in. He was absolutely lovely. He did his own x-ray, explained it all to us in detail. And he was shocked and kind of horrified as to why she was referred for surgery. He said, there's absolutely no way I'm touching these hips. He said, I can see from her last x-ray 6 months ago, they're actually healing themselves. The shape of the socket is changing naturally. So we left her for another 6 months. We went back for review and it just kept getting better and better. And then she's five and her hips are perfect.
And you're confident of that now, that there's no issues at all with her hips?
Well, after today, I don't know. I was. Katie, I don't know what to believe anymore. You know, you think you're doing the right thing and you believe the doctors, but I don't know. I don't know. I feel like we're kind of in this limbo now. Because we didn't have the surgery, we're not getting letters, we're not getting contacted. So I don't know what the next step is, really.
When you think about how close you came to, you know, and handing her over for surgery, basically, for her going in to have that surgery, after, as you say, after all the effort you had made and all the things you had put her through to avoid the surgery.
It's horrifying, like the guilt I feel. And I know people say, oh, don't feel guilty, Kerry. You know, you were just doing what you thought you needed to do. But I would have handed my child over. I won't go into details about the hip surgery because I don't want to upset anyone, but it's not nice. And I would have handed my child over to have that done to her and the pain that goes with that and the recovery for nothing. And it just really very upsetting. There's a lot of guilt there that we would have done that, you know?
And as you say, it was just that that reorganisation of patients and staff at that time that you just ended up getting lucky you got that second opinion. And as you say now, you are outside of this audit because you never did get that surgery.
were on the list. We were referred. So how many families like us were also wrongly referred? I don't know. I don't think that's being studied. Maybe it is. I don't know.
And just to remind people, if they're just catching up with this story, this is a report, an audit that was done on a random number of cases, actually. And the audit was triggered by a whistleblower who had concerns about some of the surgeries that were being done in Temple Street and Kappa in particular, and that they did not meet the criteria that would have been used in other hospitals for those surgeries. And this what this report has found is that in, I think, 80% of the cases, 79% of the cases in Kappa would not have met the criteria. 60% in Temple Street would not have met the criteria. But almost all the surgeries for hip dysplasia that had been done in Crumlin Children's Hospital would have met the criteria. So that gives you a good indication of how much variance there was in terms of decisions that were being made about putting children on the operating table for this surgery. I mean, you must thank your lucky stars, Kerry, on one. I know it's very upsetting and
absolutely
very distressing.
Like, we feel, my heart just breaks for the families that did have the surgery, you know, and what they were feeling. And I can empathise. As I said, we didn't get the surgery, but we were so close. And yeah, I feel very, very lucky. But I also feel angry. I feel angry for those families. I feel sad. A lot of emotions there.
There absolutely are. I should give out, there is a parent information line open. I'll just give those numbers out now. There's a free phone, 1-800-807-050, or there is a Dublin number. It's just disappeared from my screen as I'm reading it now. Just one second. The Dublin number is 240-8706. That's if you're calling it from outside Ireland. It's 353-1-240-8706. And I'm told that is open Monday to Friday, 8 a.m. To 8 p.m. and Saturday and Sunday. It's going to be open from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. And I think that's going to be is a huge issue for people today, because all those parents got a letter some time ago saying that there was going to be an audit. But this report was put out today, and there has been no further information yet for parents in terms of whether or not their children was operated on unnecessarily, which is, I'm sure, it's a heavy burden to carry. Kerry, thank you so much for telling
thank
us
you
your story. And as
thank
I say, we will be following this, and we'll be talking to another parent after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Kim, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
Kim, tell me about your daughter, Chrissy. She had double hip surgery in 2023, is that right?
That's right, yeah. So she was diagnosed with hip dysplasia, bilateral hip dysplasia, when she was about 13 months old, and referred then for treatment. And she had the double hip surgery in November 23.
Okay. Well, look, take us back, because Chrissy has a lot going on, doesn't she, before she ever had this diagnosis?
She did, yeah. So she did have a failure to thrive. She had a poor swallow. And so from about 11 weeks old, Chrissy was an inpatient in hospital, and she was fed by a PEG feeding tube up until this year.
Right. And when did she first then start having issues with her hips?
So she was not sitting unassisted by the time she should have been. She wasn't really meeting her developmental milestones of sitting unassisted or crawling. So at about 12 months, she finally started to kind of hold her own waist, and she started to crawl. But she wasn't using her left leg at all to crawl. She was kind of pulling herself in a commando-style crawl. So I just felt like maybe something wasn't right, and I took her to the GP then.
And that was when you were referred to Temple Street?
That's right, yeah. So she had an X-ray, and the X-ray came back that she had bilateral hip dysplasia.
Which means both sides?
Yes.
So what was the initial treatment plan then?
So initially when we seen the doctor at the hospital, he decided that the dysplasia was mild and, you know, a wait-and-see approach would be the best option, and that he would monitor every maybe 3 months, and we would go to the outpatient clinic every 3 months, have an X-ray and see how we get on.
Okay, and did you do that then? How did that go?
Yeah, so we did that, and the next time we went back, so 3 months later, we went back for the appointment. She had the x-ray, and when we seen the doctor, he had a look and he said, you know, I'm not really sure that this is kind of improving as I'd hoped. He said, I think I will refer her for the surgery. So she was put on the waiting list then at that point. So she would have been maybe 1.5 or, you know, maybe coming up to the age of 2.
Okay, and then how come it took so long then for the actual surgery to take place?
So while waiting, we signed the forms, consent forms, and while waiting for the surgery, we were called again for our, you know, 3 or 6 month appointment just for checkup at the hospital. And when we went to that checkup, she did x-ray again, and the same doctor decided, you know what, actually, it looks like it's improving. I will remove her from the surgery waiting list and we'll give her another 3 or 6 months and see how we get on. So we went ahead, we waited that time. And when we went back to the following appointment, it was decided, you know, actually, she does need the surgery. I will operate. I will operate as a matter of urgency because you were on the list, you were removed from the list. So he said, I'll operate on her as soon as a bed becomes available. A few weeks later, we got a call on a Tuesday to say, bring her in Friday morning and we'll do the surgery.
So you must have been actually delighted to get, you know, because we all know about surgical waiting lists here for children in particular.
Absolutely. And because we felt, you know, that we had waited so long from the initial appointment, and because by the time Chrissy's dysplasia was identified, she was past the stage where a child could be treated with, you know, a harness that night or any of those other types of treatments like casting. So the only way we were told to, you know, to fix this issue would be the surgery. So we were a bit anxious to have it done.
And were both hips as bad as each other? Was that what you were told or...?
No, one was slightly milder than the other. We were told both hips were mild anyway. One was slightly, needed a slightly more than the other, but both did have an element of dysplasia.
Now, I know that you didn't quite appreciate when you signed the consent exactly how traumatic that surgery would be for Chrissy.
Yeah, not at all. We were worried, I was just under the impression she'll go in, it was to be keyhole surgery, you know, that she wouldn't require any casting or any bracing afterwards, you know, that she'd be absolutely fine after a few days. And that just wasn't the case. It was a far bigger surgery than we could have ever managed. Chrissy was traumatised afterwards still to this day. She's a regular GP visit. She's saying, don't let him touch my legs. It was a huge surgery. It was a huge recovery where she had to learn to walk all over again. She couldn't be washed. She had to be put back into nappies because you couldn't lift her onto the potty because you couldn't bend her at the waist. It was very traumatic on the whole household because we couldn't leave the house where it was a long recovery.
Was she actually in pain at that stage, or was it just the complications of movement and all of that?
Just the complications of movement. The pain was managed really well. You know, we just made sure we got up through the night and we gave her, you know, the Calpol and the Nurofen. We never missed a dose. So the pain was managed well. But when you try to lift or manipulate her from the waist, you know, when you lift up a child, you normally kind of bend the knees up. She couldn't do any of that. So when you did try to move it, she would have been in pain. So she just lay flat on the sofa for about 2 weeks.
So... you got through that. It was a number of months, I think, before she was walking back to normal again.
Yeah.
So when did you first get an inkling that maybe there was a question mark over all of those surgeries?
I'm just part of a developmental hip dysplasia Facebook group, and other people who were due to have the surgery Chrissy had advised that their surgeries were cancelled pending an investigation. But we knew nothing about it at all until we received a letter in the post from Temple Street saying that there was going to be an audit of children operated on between 21 and 23 and that it was, you know, they're going to just follow up. It was a very kind of casual letter. Don't worry about anything, you know, this is quite normal, we'll review. But it seemed to have not been the case just from talking to other parents that the threshold that they used within Temple Street and other hospitals to decide if a child needed the surgery was much lower than the threshold used in other hospitals. So we now question, did our child need this surgery at all?
Yeah, because of course there was a report, a draft report that was leaked. It was on the Ditch website some time ago. And today that full report, the final report, has been now issued. And that is what it says. It is questioning whether some surgeries were actually required at all, whether the children yeah. Would have recovered without surgery. Yeah. In particular, I suppose we should just tell people again, it's Temple Street and Kappa were the two hospitals where there seemed to have been a different threshold for in the case of Kappa, 80%, in the case of Temple Street, 60% of the surgeries. So when you heard that, Kim, what did you think?
To be honest, we were just shocked and I'm just devastated to think that we may have put her through a massive surgery that potentially she did not need. I'm 100% sure that she's one of the children that didn't need a surgery, because my husband and I recall a conversation with the doctor and he said, oh, you know, if Chrissy was referred to Crumlin, they would never have done this surgery. And I took that to mean, like, how lucky are we that he's going to fix this problem now before she's older? And, you know, if we had went to Crumlin, she probably would have been, you know, 11 or 12 before they decided to do it.
So you were told that Chrissy would not have been operated on the basis of her tests or x-rays if she had been in Crumlin.
Yeah, and like, obviously knowing what we know now is a different story, but when you're told that and you're anxious for your child to have this, you know, dysplasia fixed, you think, how, you know, this is fantastic. Like, thank God she was sent to Temple Street. We're going to get her sorted now before she's a teenager, before, you know, any other issues become apparent. We're so lucky we're here. And actually, that's how I feel now, that I will be notified that she did not need that surgery, because I feel I was already told that, you know.
There is also a part of that report refers to a novel technique being used on some of the children, and in some cases that consent, informed consent, hadn't been obtained.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea if Chrissy was part of that?
She did. Yes, she did. So she had this novel procedure. As far as we were made aware, the novel procedure, all we were told was it meant she didn't need to have a brace or casting afterwards. So we were, our opinion was like that this is just a surgery that's, you know, maybe been used hundreds of times, but they have now decided that this is the best practice. I wasn't aware that, you know, it wasn't the common practice procedure that was being used. We had no idea of that. I just felt, oh, this is great. At least she's not going to be stuck, you know, in a buggy or on her bed in a brace for a couple of months after the surgery.
But you were told about that before the surgery, that this was going to be a technique. Just to say, the line from the report, from the RT report on this, is the audit found that a novel technique was used in Temple Street and Kappa in some cases, and that there was no informed consent. Did you give informed consent, do you think?
I don't think so, because I don't feel like I had the full details. I don't feel like I understood or I was made aware that this was a novel procedure. I just feel like the information we were given was that it was a better procedure or an easier procedure to recover from.
Where you're at now, Kim, you've had that one communication. Is that the only communication you've had, that letter from Temple Street?
That's all I've received. So I have not been notified if my child was found to be one of the children operated on unnecessarily. Like, there's been no transparency. I don't know, will they ever tell us? I don't know. I don't know where we go from here. I don't know if we should go for, you know, see another orthopaedic surgeon and just, you know, and ask them to have a look to make sure there's no long-term damage done if she was operated on when her hips were healthy.
The surgery, as you say, you were thinking keyhole surgery, you know, a minor enough procedure.
Yes.
But this surgery actually involved taking a bone from the pelvis for a bone graft. So, is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So we didn't know about that until we went to the follow-up appointment and we, you know, after the surgery, and the x-ray was pulled up and we could see two little triangles of bone removed from Chrissy's pelvis and attached to the outside of the hip bone. We also didn't know until we spoke to other parents that there was dissolvable screws used to hold that new bone in place. We really didn't have any idea of the level of surgery that Chrissy was having. And when she went for the dressing change after the surgery, and they took away the dressings on her hips. They were substantial scars with stitching, which we just, I just assumed it was going to be, you know, dissolvable little stitch after over a tiny keyhole within the hip. But they weren't. They were quite substantial scars on our hips with, and stitched up.
How do you feel about the whole thing now, Kim?
I just feel sick. I feel like people are saying to me, why didn't you get a second opinion? And it's making me feel like I failed the child. But I took in good faith that I was seen as one of the best surgeons around and that the information he gave me was right. Like, why would I question the professional? I didn't, you know, I just feel physically sick. We've had so many sleepless nights where we feel like, why have we done this? She was already, after going through so much, and we allowed her to have this massive surgery that she may not have even needed. It's awful. It's horrible. Absolutely horrible.
Kim, I can completely understand why you would feel like that.
Yeah, I know. And I just hope that the hospital give us some transparency, you know, put us out of our misery and let us know if they, you know, if she was one of those children, just to let us know so we can stop worrying about it. You know, if we find out she was, like, then we know we can get some information of what we should do next. But while we're left in the dark, we're the ones sitting at home completely traumatised by it all.
Kim, thank you so much for telling us your story and the very best of luck. How is Chrissy today?
She's really good. She's a little bit unsteady on her feet that we find, you know, she kind of falls a little bit more than other children her age, but she's done really well. She's overcome her failure to thrive. The peg feeding tube was removed this year and she's eating orally. So, look, she's thriving. She's fantastic.
Great to hear. Mind yourself and mind Chrissy, Kim. Thanks for telling us your story.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now, what incredible mothers we had there, and what an astonishing, shocking story this is, what has been going on in Kappa and Temple Street with these surgeries. And we didn't even mention that it's in the report as well, that one of the children who got this surgery, despite not meeting the criteria for getting the surgery, experienced what is described as an adverse outcome from the operation. So, and everyone knows anytime you go in for surgery, that is always a possibility. We'll move on. But before I go, I'll give those helplines again. The parent information line is open now, I'm told. Free phone 1-800-807-050. If you're calling from outside Ireland, it's 00353124087 06. That's 2408706. And I'm told those lines are open Monday to Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. and on Saturday and Sunday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Anticipate that we will be hearing a lot more about this in the coming days and weeks. We'll move on for the moment, and I'll bring in Pat. Pat, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Kitty.
Yeah, Pat, you got in touch because we were talking about this during the week on the show on the back of Tom Gilligan, the Mayo County Council official, who emailed councillors with a proposal that holiday home owners should be boycotted because it was having such an impact on the housing availability in Mayo. There's so many houses that are not occupied for a lot of the time. Now, I should say Tom Gilligan has apologised, said that he did not mean for that to go for public consumption, and he's very sorry for any distress that caused anybody. It was just an idea that he was floating with some of the councillors, so we should say that. But one of our listeners yesterday got in touch saying, if you want to encourage holiday homeowners to sell those homes, have a look at the capital gains tax that they're paying, because it's 33%, of course, capital gains tax on those properties. And they're saying, if you give a little amnesty, that you could maybe encourage people to put those houses back on the market. You have another thought on that, Pat?
Yes, Kitty, I do. My thoughts on it was, if you give an amnesty, sometimes it's taken and sometimes it's not. People who want to sell their holiday homes will sell them anyway. But I'm mainly interested in the accidental landlords, or maybe for self-employed people that bought a house way back years ago in order to create a pension. They're left with the same situation today, where if they sell it and they make a profit on it, even people that bought a house the time of the last boom. It's back up into the same value now, or maybe a wee bit more, and they lost 33% of that. Now, what I wanted to say was that...
Sorry, how do you mean, Pat, they lost 33% of that?
Well, any profit that they will make on the house, and maybe the house has been there for a number of years, right? Accidental landlords, if they make a profit on it, they will lose 33% of that.
Yeah, mind you, I just put the opposite point of view. They will keep 66% of that profit.
That would be, yes. Uh-huh.
I'm just imagining people say, you know, hard to feel that sorry for people.
No, well, what I think should be done, the government is encouraging us all to have pensions, and we'll be bringing in the pensions later on. I think maybe it's pushed back now again.
This is the auto-enrollment pension, yeah.
Why not allow any person that has a second house that wants to sell it to put that money into their pension? They can't get the money to spend it anywhere else. It has to go into a pension to create a pension for them.
Oh, so you're saying that they would forego the capital gains tax and allow them to put that towards their pension instead?
Towards their pension, absolutely.
As you say, a lot of those houses would have been, when you're talking about the once-off houses that they might have been bought with a view to, you know, sorting out a pension plan for somebody who was self-employed.
Mm-hmm. That's right, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, that might be more palatable maybe to some people.
I know, yes, I know for a lot of people they would think that, as you stated yesterday, Katie, a lot of people will think if you have a second house, well, you can afford to pay the tax.
Indeed.
And that is right enough. So therefore, rather than having an amnesty, have it set up in such a way that the money gained has to be used towards your pension. No exceptions.
That would be even worth more to people then, though, wouldn't it? Because there's other tax advantages of money going into your pension in terms of when it comes back out, you don't pay the same amount of tax on it.
Well, that's a different story. You can look at that day there, but, you know, it depends. It probably would depend on age and one thing and another as well. But, a lot of people will actually hand down the property rather than pay the 33% on it. And if it's handed down over a certain number of years, then, you know, it falls to the next generation. But for anybody that wants to sell or wants to create, basically sell houses, allow them to do that.
Yeah, and I have to say, like, one way or another, whether it's this or some other ideas coming forward, there are a lot of houses that are under-occupied around the country, and there has to be more creative ideas brought forward to do something about that and to encourage them to be used for one way or another, because it is, completely understand how angry you would be if you can't afford to buy a home and live in the area you want to live in that maybe you grew up in, and yet there's all these houses, lovely houses, sitting idle for, you know, 10 or 11 months of the year. It would just drive you crackers, wouldn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Do you have a holiday home yourself, Pat?
No, I don't, but I am an accidental landlord.
Ah, so you do have a second property.
I do, yes. Mainly my pension.
Right.
And at the time it was bought, there was no word of, well, again, I wasn't made aware that anything I made on it would be subject to 33% capital gains tax.
Okay. So I see now that we're trying to sort out your tax arrangements here live on air, Pat.
Well, I've already tried to sort it out, and there doesn't seem to be any way around it. So therefore the property is sitting there. It's not been sold.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's as far as it, I would be lucky to get back actually what I paid for it. So there are not an awful lot of gains on it, but I can see a situation where people, and I know different people that have houses and are not selling it for that reason.
And if the capital gains tax were reduced significantly, because I have a vague memory of doing this years ago when Charlie McCreevy, God, that's how long back we're going, but he did a massive cut on capital gains for a period there. And I think his explanation for it was that, look, we're not getting anything in on it at the moment because it's so high, so we might as well get half of what we're not getting. So would you think about selling if it was, say, brought down to, I don't know, 20%, 15%?
Bring it, just as Charlie McGreevy once said, bring it down half it. bring it down to 15%. Absolutely, wouldn't be a problem.
Would you sell then? Would that be how low would you have to go before you'd put it on the market?
Well, if it is at the minute, if it's 33, we're allowed to put it into a pension fund or bring it down to 15%, yeah, that would be definitely slightly more palatable.
Yeah.
It's not going to make an awful lot of difference to me personally, but at the same time, it is going to make a difference to different people out there, you know, whether it maybe has a couple of properties.
Yeah. Pat, it's an interesting one. We'll put it out there. We'll see what other people think about it. But as I say, we have to come up with some creative ideas to do this because we cannot carry on the way we're carrying on. That is for sure. Pat, thanks for that.
Thank you very much, Katie, for allowing me to put my point across.
You're very welcome. Take a break.
Joe Duffy. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Or text us on 51551. Now, we learned in the last few days that the Minister for Housing and Heritage, Minister James Brown, said that the Normans left their mark in a monumental ways in Ireland and announced that organisations can now submit projects for the 2027 commemoration of the Normans. It turns out 2027 is the European Year of the Normans. And we are planning to have various commemorations by what it sounds. I see that Angus O'Snodig, the Sinn Féin TD, says this is offensive. He talks about the Normans being responsible for 900 years of occupation. And we should be reminding ourselves of the legacy of William the Conqueror's successors invading and subjugating Ireland in the name of his English crown. Connor, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Katie.
Connor, you are the author of Strongbow, the Norman Invasion of Ireland.
Right.
So if I ask you the question, what did the Normans ever do for us?
Yeah. it is like that scene. And, I want to give a balanced opinion. I don't want to say the Normans were great. I think if you were an Irish landowner who was muscled out of your property, who was killed, driven off, you've got nothing positive to say about them. But there are positives, and one of the biggest for me is if we look at the situation before the arrival of the Normans in terms of the poorest people in Ireland, the slaves, the Normans abolished slavery. So before the arrival of the Normans, the unit of currency here was the cumul, was the female slave. It's a cattle economy. It's a lot of butter, a lot of cheese. And to make that is backbreaking work in the 12th century. So there's a big market for female slaves spending their days making butter that they're not allowed to touch to their lips. And Dublin is a massive city. It's one of Europe's great cities. But the wealth of Dublin is the wealth of the slave trade. So that all comes to an end with the Normans. They have a different system, a more grain-based system based on serfdom, still not a pleasant existence, but way, way better than being a slave.
And what
so
did
that
they,
for me is one so, very big positive.
And I read about this before, but what was it that the Normans had against slavery? I mean, slavery was obviously an incredibly lucrative business
good question,
at the time.
Because, you know, they weren't principled people who believed in human rights, far from it. They were a sort of might makes right crowd. If they could get their hands on wealth by any means, they would adopt those means. But pragmatically, they had learnt a different way of agriculture that was leading to great prosperity in Normandy. Grain yields there were up to maybe 14 to 1, which was fantastic for the medieval period. And it was a system where, you see, if you give the serf a bit of an interest in the land, then you're going to take a lot of the crop off them, but they get to keep some of it. So it gives them the incentive to move those heavy rocks, to drain the land, to improve it. Whereas a slave has none of that incentive. So
it's a touch of
pragmatic reasons.
A touch of Thatcherism there, really, isn't it? give the serfs a stake in society, and they will. They will come on board.
Exactly that kind of, it's incentivizing them rather than just shackling them. But there would be other positives as well. I mean, especially for the eastern ports, there would be a prosperity for Waterford, Wexford, Dublin. There would be a lot of new towns founded. There would be an improvement in technology, in pottery and metalworking. So you know, for me, I see them more as the way we see the Vikings. You know, the Vikings, when they came to Ireland, were terrible, especially if you were in a monastery that was gutted and sacked and all the silverware stolen. And yet, over the centuries, the Vikings adapt to Irish life and become really important first cities with walls in Ireland and so on. And part of our culture, part of their art has worked its way into Irish visual art, you know, the lovely zoomorphic designs. But they bring that with them. And I see the Normans as the same. So they're not the start of the imperial relationship. I think that happens under Elizabeth I. And in fact, as Angus O'Snodgrass did say, to be fair to him, it was Normans who'd adapted to the Irish way of life who led the opposition to the Tudors. So, you know, there's a it's more nuanced than seeing them as just a the start of the of 900 years of oppression. Hmm.
Of course, I think one of the issues that people have taken issue with is that the date that has been picked for this European year of the Normans is to commemorate the birth of William the Conqueror in particular, isn't it? And that where would you stand on celebrating William the Conqueror, Conor?
I'm not a particular fan of kings and queens, and in his case, a duke becoming a king. I would know, and you know, and I think it's disproportionate to celebrate. I mean, he's not even English, you know. He's French. The people who come to Ireland probably see themselves more as French than English. They certainly spoke a version of French rather than a version of English. So, it's a stage of European history that's fascinating, that's important, influential, and of course, we can't really celebrate the life of a Norman peasant because we know nothing about them, whereas we do know a lot about William's life because his success led to lots of historians writing about him. So I suppose if you're going to pick one Norman that everybody knows and you want to sort of do something around that, fair enough, make it William the Conqueror. But I would want to tell the story of the common people rather than the story of a king and a duke.
Will you hang on, Conor, because I've got I've got Dermot Power on the other line. Dermot, good afternoon.
Hello, Kelly. How are you?
Dermot, you're an expert in this area as well.
Well, I'm not an expert on it, but I mean, I wasn't even aware of it. In your research, you called me this morning and said it to me, and I'd say, like, why? Why would you celebrate? What are we to celebrate? I mean, when the Normans came here, and they came, you know, Strongbow first, they came more or less to Waterford, and, you know, killed practically the whole population of the town, both the Vikings and also the O'Faolans, and that was an Irish tribe, and in the city. So, I mean, the historic record says that. And so we go on from there. Then the Vikings were giving the protection of English law. The Irish weren't. We have a case here in Waterford where a man was killed, and the defence by the person who killed him said, well, he was an Irishman. There's no, you know, that's not against the law to kill an Irishman, but it was to kill a Viking. So, and on it goes, and on it goes, and there was I know people say they became as Irish themselves, to a degree. But if we come forward, and from, I think the gentleman speaking just there a minute ago, more or less said it, from the Tudor period, from Henry VIII, there was a determined effort to grab all the land of Ireland. And up to the mid-1700s, there was only about 3% of the land of Ireland owned by Irish Catholics. The rest was owned by English Protestants. I'm not saying that was a religious thing. This is a fact that most of the land, and they still retain it, Katie. Their descendants still retain it. So I can see absolutely nothing to commemorate. It's like saying to some Frenchman, well, let's commemorate the invasion of the Nazis in England in 200 years' time.
Let's try and not bring the Nazis into the conversation at this stage, Dermot.
Well, I mean, I'm only making a comparison of why they wouldn't, and nobody would suggest, but the amount of Irish people were killed over that particular period, right, from the invasion of the Normans, they took all our land. There was nothing practically left. A lot of them still own the land. You know, they own the rivers, they own the fish in the rivers, and that's a fact.
Conor?
Yeah, but Dermot, when you say our land, you're missing a really important distinction. I agree that the Irish aristocracy lost their land, but the Irish slaves got a better life. So we have to be careful about our language here. Ireland did not lose out. Some people in Ireland lost out.
Well, I think that... I think most of the people in Ireland lost out. If you look at the amount of deaths from that period right on to the Cromwellian period, our population, I think in the 1600s, essentially halved. Now, they were either sent away as slaves, some people like to say indentured servants, or else they were killed. So, you know, I can't see any favours being done by the Norman invasion and the subsequent events in our history.
And again, I think we have to kind of break it down and look at the different stages. So there is a stage in which the relationship to Britain is terrible for Ireland, and it is the cause of death. It is the horror of the famine years. But I would argue that stage doesn't come until the Tudors. And that, okay, the 14th century has the Black Death, right? Half of Europe's population is wiped out. I don't think we can blame the Normans. And I certainly wouldn't draw a parallel with the Nazis, because the overall effect of the way of life of Ireland is a positive one due to the impact of the Normans. The harm that comes to Ireland is that they draw in the interest of the King of England. And once the Kings of England are starting to look at Ireland and starting to think they can get money out of Ireland, then yes, that's a big problem. That's something that's terrible. But my sort of bottom line takeaway is this: if anyone's listening to the show who has a Norman heritage, that is something to be proud of. It's an important part of our history and culture.
And Conor, just remind us, because a huge number of names that we consider very, very Irish names are Norman names, or clearly coming from that
they
Norman.
They are, but we...
Remind us. Who,
they
like
are,
the,
and, the, you know, but if you sort of multiply down through the family trees from that period to now, it would account for millions of us. On the other hand, many of the serfs on the land of a Norman would take that Norman surname. So, you know, you'd have to do the DNA test to really nail
it down. That's exactly right. And I think that most of the names, my own name is Power, I don't believe for one iota that I'm descended from the Normans. I got my DNA test and there's no French signature, a very, very little English signature in mine. It's mostly Irish. Name like Barry's and all those names, I think, were the same. As you said, you know, we worked on the land and we were known, belonging to the Barry's or the Powers. We were simply called the Powers. I mean, like water, but it's full of powers. And we're not, I don't believe for a moment, that we're descended from the original Powers that came here. So I think you're quite right in saying that.
Yeah, but I think his point, though, Dermot, is that, you know, it's the land-owning classes that got pushed aside by the Normans, but the lowest rung of the ladder, you know, might have something to celebrate with the arrival of the Normans.
Let me put it this way: the Countess Desmond here, she was one of the butlers, but married into the Powers, and there was a famous case in England in the courts in England about it, and the saying was that the more that she laughed, that the more her tenants wept. Like, you know, so I just can't understand why we'd want to celebrate something that was a disaster for our country. It's simply, in every sense of the word, right up to the present time, you know, Ireland is not, it is now, thank God, completely settled. But how many years was it unsettled? And there was continuous strife in the country. And as I said, we were always, the Irish were always, and I refer back again to the fact that we did not get the protection of English law from the outset. The Irish did not get it. As time went on, we were expelled from the cities. You know, we had to make our way. We had to live in forests. I mean, you see, I might say, and I've seen it during the decades of centenaries, sometimes people get jobs to do historic things who have a very superficial knowledge of Irish history. Now, wasn't there another case there during that centenary that we're going to celebrate? Was it the RIC or someone, or the Blackened Hands and that? Yeah, you know, I mean, like that turned and pear-shaped. Now, listen, I have no objection. So if it's going to be a festival and it brings in a bit of money into the country, fair enough.
Okay, but well, look on that. You won't be going. You won't be going, Dermot. Hang on. I got Catherine McPartlin. Good afternoon to you.
Hello, Katie. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, so you're from the medieval Ferns experience.
Yes.
So tell me about that. So
I suppose Ferns has known as the ancient capital of Leinster, because basically the Gaelic kings of Leinster ruled from Ferns. And we also have a saint who founded a monastery in the 6th and 7th century. But what makes us, I suppose, in this discussion relevant is because our Diarmaid MacMurra, Gaelic king of Leinster, invited the Normans to Ireland.
So it's all his fault.
It's all his fault. Now, we did put him on trial in 2019. We had a high court judge in St. Edan's Cathedral in Ferns who... with four or five barristers. We had Strongbow, we had the High King. Look, we said he was a man of his time. And it's a very complex story. And by the way, I think this discussion is fantastic and a great example of what can be further explored in 2027. To me, and to many involved, also a member of the Wexford Normandy Cultural Association, and to us, it's about exploring our shared interests, to developing new relationships and making strengthening existing. But I think we need to look at who are the Normans. If you look back, and there have been references before, but they're a mix of Anglo-Norman. They were descendants of the Vikings who had invaded Normandy and subsequently invaded England. So William the Conqueror was never in Ireland, so we've no reason to celebrate him, but it must be noted that it was his descendants. So I suppose that's the connection to the year of the Normans.
Yeah. And just, I need to take a break, but is it true that they introduced rabbits to Ireland?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And our landscape, if you travel through Normandy, through Wexford, you'll see a similar landscape, the brocage, as they call it there, with the hedges. They introduce field systems. They build castles, which are not the mainstay, but one of the key pillars of our tourism industry. We're fortunate to have a Norman castle in Ferns, huge Norman history.
So you'll be putting in a few ideas to the Minister for commemorating.
Okay.
Let me just tell you, Catherine. Dermot won't be going. So,
yeah, you never know. We rule nothing out. We had a Saint Bernard in at our 2019 inquiry, so you never know.
Okay. Catherine, thank you for that, and Dermot, thank you, and Connor, really interesting.
Joe Duffy. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now I want to go back to that story we opened the programme with, that a report out today telling us that hundreds of children that were put through hip dysplasia surgeries in Temple Street and Kappa Orthopaedic Hospital didn't need those operations. They did not meet the criteria to have those operations. And people just learning this today. This comes out of an audit that was done following a whistleblower protected disclosure. And I want to bring in Susan now. Susan, good afternoon to you.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, Susan. Susan, I understand you have three daughters that are caught up in this. Well, actually, your first daughter fell outside the scope of the audit because she had a hip operated on in 2019 when she was 2.5. And I should say, the audit we heard about today, it was a snapshot in time. A number of cases were looked at by a consultant. So we don't know really what else we need to know outside of the dates that were looked at. And it's important to say that. But anyway, in terms of that daughter, you had all those awful interventions to deal with that we heard from Kerry earlier on in the show, the pelvic harness, the spica cast. Horrendous for families and for the babies themselves to deal with. But I want to talk about your second daughter. She was born in 2018. She did fall under the terms of the audit, and you did get a letter relating to her surgery in Kappa in 2022. So maybe we can start there. How did your journey with your second daughter begin?
Yeah, so I suppose the second daughter would have had the standard checkups, you know, when they're born, the clicky hip and the ultrasound of 6 weeks, which they offer to anybody that has, say, a history of hip dysplasia in the family. So she essentially passed those tests, but because her sister would have been obviously through the system prior to her, they had agreed that they would review her, you know, through the same process as her sister had gone through. So she would have had, I suppose, x-rays and checkups each time frame when she was due to be checked. But her hip dysplasia was slightly different to her sister's. So,
and did she Susan, but did she have the harness and the spica cast? Did she do all of that?
No, she had no intervention before operation.
Oh. And did they explain to you why they weren't recommending her for that?
So basically, I think there's different types of hip dysplasia depending on their needs. So she didn't obviously have the requirement for the harness or the speaker cast at the time, whereas my other daughter would have had all that intervention. But it was only as they were reviewing her x-rays, you know, each time she went in, they'd say, oh, well, she definitely has occipitalar dysplasia. She wasn't kind of improving or she wasn't getting worse. But obviously, a decision has to be made at some point, whether you fix it or not. Like, but based on the audit, it looks like that they used a certain grading system, obviously, to determine whether they operated on or not. And obviously, she was a case that was then operated on.
So when did you realise that she was going to need the surgery or she was going to get the surgery?
It was always kind of in the back of our minds that she was going to have surgery because obviously her sister had had similar surgery. And we were always concerned that she would be pushed out, like she would be left in the system waiting for years to be done. Because at the time when her sister would have been done, there was a huge waiting period. So that's what we were worried about with her second daughter. But then when we were informed that surgery was readily available, I suppose, we went on the list then for Kappa Kids then.
And describe then, Susan, the day that she went into the operating theatre.
So we obviously fill out your forms like you do with any operation that you have done. And she was very anxious on the morning of the surgery and they had to give her, I think it was Valium or something to relax her. She was completely spaced out before the operation. And then she went down to surgery and during surgery, she was down there quite a bit of time. And then they came up, I'd say, halfway through the time. And they had mentioned that it was both hips that she had to get done and not just the one.
Stop you there? So you thought when she went in for that surgery, she was just getting one of her hips done?
It was mentioned at the last consultation before the procedure that sometimes on occasion when they do one hip, that they have to measure it and make sure it's level and that they sometimes have to do a second hip. But all along, it was only ever one hip that she had the dysplasia on, like any x-ray we ever seen with them. They only ever spoke about one side of the hip. They never spoke about both of the hips. And then on the morning, we obviously had to sign a form to say that they would review, obviously, and if needed, that they'd let us know. Like, so obviously they did come up to let us know that she did need both hips done, but we were kind of shocked because it was never, ever... We never thought she was going to have both done, if you know what I mean.
Yes, and so literally somebody came out of the operating theatre to tell you that. And did you have to give consent separately for that?
So it was just on the form we filled out. So the form you filled out, you know, when you're going in for surgery, that you know, things can go wrong or whatever you sign for. It was at that stage that it said that they may have to do both hips, but it was never in our minds that she would have the both done. You know, we just thought it was general procedure, like that they mentioned that.
Yeah. So then, of course, you're immediately onto a different kind of recovery then with both hips done.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like?
It was awful. She found it very hard to cope with it. She was very anxious. She was wet in the bed again. She just found it very, very hard to cope with the recovery of it all. And she was in a lot of pain actually for the first 24 hours in the hospital. Like she was in an awful lot of pain after it. But still to this day, as a result, is very, a very anxious child, I would say.
And just like in terms of, what age was she again at this stage, Susan?
She was 4 and a bit.
But so in terms of like toileting, managing all of that, what was that like?
Yeah, so I had to be a home with her for 6 weeks. So she couldn't go, she'd only just started school. So she had to take 6 weeks off school. And we had to lift her in and out of the toilet, obviously, because she would have been potty trained, but she was obviously wet in the bed at night time because of the whole process. Like, she was quite, you know, she could remember the whole procedure of the anaesthetic and all. Like, she could tell you the name of the nieces and everything. Like, it's so funny. But she found it very, very hard to settle, I have to say. And the scars are quite large on her, to my other daughters. And when we went in for our checkup, we were basically told if they bother her when she gets to her teen years, that they'd look at it then.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we were hearing during the show, like that when the bandages came off, there was really, really some, the incision is very large for these surgeries.
It is. Yeah, she has it on both.
And in terms of pain and all of that, were you able to manage all of that?
Yeah, I was able to manage her pain. Like, she was in a lot of pain for the first kind of, especially in the hospital, like she woke up screaming, like, she was quite young, obviously, and it's quite a big deal, you know, yourself to even go through a procedure, never mind when you're a child, like going through it all. But yeah, we managed obviously with the Calpol and the Nurofen, and she wasn't put in a cast or anything after surgery. She was just as was, like, and you brought her home.
And from your own situation, were you at home full time, Susan, or what? How were you able to manage all of this?
No, so I had to take time off work to be at home with her, because she couldn't go anywhere, like, for the first 6 weeks, or she couldn't even walk for the first kind of 10 days. Like, she was kind of learning to walk again. Like,
God, it's so stressful. I mean, I can only imagine.
Yeah.
Okay, so, but again, at this point, you thought you'd done the right thing. You'd luckily, you know, both hips were caught, and, you know, this is, you know, she will go on and she will be fine. At what point did you then have realised that maybe there were questions to be asked here?
I suppose when around late last year, there was obviously, you heard stuff circulating around social media and that, and I had spoken to my husband that I'd seen something, but again, you can't till you know it actually affects you, if you know what I mean, do anything about it. So I wouldn't worry about something till it became that it was a problem of mine. But then when I got the letter then for my second daughter, I actually just felt sick, and I was worried then about the first daughter. You know, I know she wasn't in the time frame they did the audit, but she still should have had a follow-up measure in place. Like, so you start thinking all sorts. You have guilt, like, did you make the right decision? You put your child in their hands, like, to think that it's the right thing to do.
When you got that letter confirming that your second daughter was in the audit,
yeah,
what went through your head?
I straight away thought she has to be a case, because she ticks a lot of the boxes, that she was young, she had bilateral ostomy done when she only ever had a problem with one hip. She'd no intervention, obviously, with speaker or anything before then. So I kind of did feel, and still do feel, that possibly she could be one of these cases. But regardless of what's been audited, like, they have that doesn't even put a stab at probably the amount of children that have gone through this process. This is just based on the cases they've reviewed, like.
Yeah, and just to remind people again, if they're only coming to this now, what we're being told is there was, I think, 147 cases reviewed between the three hospitals, and they found that in the case of Temple Street, 60% of the surgeries that were done for hip dysplasia on children during that window, the 3-year window, would not have met the criteria. And in the case of the Kappa, almost 80% of the cases would not have met the criteria, and those operations would have been considered unnecessary. Do you have questions now? What questions would you have left now, Susan, in terms of the audit and what's going to have to happen?
I suppose we're very angry, in a sense that social media has received the report before the actual families that are impacted, and that they haven't reached out to any of the parents that are actually impacted, other than an automated letter. They just changed the name on the letter and the address it was sent to. Like, I think it's an absolute disgrace. And even the report coming out today, they've mentioned they have FAQs and they have a helpline. If you actually ring the helpline, they can't give you any answers. All they're doing is taking your name and number, and they don't know when they're going to get back to you either. So it's of zero benefit to the parents or the families.
Have you rang that helpline, Susan?
Yeah, and they basically tell you that they'll take your name and number. They can't give you any information. They don't know when they're going to be making the call back. There's no information for the parents. It's a waste of time ringing them.
And there was I thinking I was doing good public service giving out that number. We'll give it out again, just because I suppose we need to get people's numbers to whoever is going to answer the questions eventually. But
you're saying even on that helpline you're not getting much out of it. I know your third daughter, you have another daughter, and she's actually now being monitored for this condition.
Yeah, she's been monitored. She's the similar dysplasia that my second daughter had, which is this occipitalar dysplasia, which I reckon from the audit they're saying isn't commonly operated on in other countries. It's something that they just monitor and it generally figures itself out, kind of thing. But yeah, she's been monitored at the minute.
If you were told now that she required surgery, how would you feel?
I think it was always a thought in our mind, I suppose, because we've been through it twice. But now with this whole report coming out, I think you'd have to get a second opinion. And obviously, we will probably get second opinions on our other two daughters anyway, just for a buffer for herself. But I think you'd have to question what system like they are using, and is it the right system? Like, you know, they need to clarify a lot more for us. And even the audit, there's a lot of medical jargon on the audit that would mean nothing to the normal person. Like, you know, like we're people at the end of the day, and the report being issued without being telling us is just crazy.
Yeah, now I did hear Colm Henry from the HSC on the news at one there, and he says there is now a common criteria in place for all children who are going to be referred for this surgery across all the CHI hospitals. So, I mean, it's important to say that, because there's obviously a lot of children out there who will need the surgery and will require it down the line. I mean, the horrible thing about this is now your trust goes, isn't that? That's the problem.
Completely, like, and that guilt that you feel as a mom is just awful. Like, anyways, like, you know, you're like, did I do the right thing? Did I make the right decision for my child? And as I say, you think you're making the right decision at the time.
Yeah. Susan, thank you so much for getting in touch, and the very best of luck with all of your children there. And thank you for sharing all of that with us today. And we've told now you won't get much information on it. This is the number anyway. This is the number we've been given for the parent information line. It's 1-800-807-050. And that's 807-050. And if you're calling from outside Ireland, it's 00-3531-240-8706. That is all we have time for. Today's programme was produced by Tara Lockery-Grant. Our broadcast coordinator was Sean Marham. Paul Murnock was on sound. The series producer is Annette Egan. Joe is back with you next week. But from me, enjoy your weekend and stand by now for Ray.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Revamp your home this May with our fresh new curtain and bedding designs. Discover comfort and style for every room.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815 or send your WhatsApp voice notes to 087 484 8888.